All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And one man in his time plays many parts. What's poppin'? Welcome to the Kane Show. I thought of what I wanted to talk about when I was taking a shower earlier after my run. There were two things that I started doing at a rather young age, definitely younger than anybody that I knew personally. One of the things I was introduced to by accident, and the other thing I was introduced to by somebody close to me that I really trust. I don't know if I'll ever find the confidence to speak on the latter, at least while that person's alive, but the first thing I'm more than confident enough to talk about today. There's a strong chance that if you're watching this, you're aware of the fact that I make content surrounding mental health maintenance and emotional literacy. Most of my knowledge when it comes to mental health is due to my need to survive. All the little tips and tricks and quotes that I have in my videos, they come from a person that truly needed them themselves. And I give them out in my videos because my goal while I'm here is to help people feel less alone in what they think, feel, and have experienced. I must have been about 5 or 6 years old, and I remember it pretty vividly, especially because a lot of the furniture that we had at that time, my mom still is holding on to. But I remember we lived at this house on Saw Street in Northeast Philly near the Saw and Pratt Frankfurt Terminal. I remember I was able to get around rather easily, and I remember going upstairs and going into her room when she was distracted at some point, probably doing something downstairs. But what I found in her room was this glass. It was a wine glass. And of course, being a kid, I was just curious. I wanted to see what was up. I wanted to see what it was. I remember sipping it, and like most kids, being taken aback by the bitterness, that flavor of alcohol. But unlike most of the people that I've encountered in my personal life, I gave it another sip, and I finished it. Talking about it with my mom these days, she doesn't even remember it. In the years that followed, especially in my late teens and early 20s, it's a moment that I think about often. I think back to that moment, and I believe because it was a precursor to now, knowing what I know, of what was to come. I remember around the age of 13, I went down the shore with my friend Colin Chabin and his family. He has a sister named Alicia, a sister named Devin, and Devin has a boyfriend, now husband, named Chris. All very good people. At the time, they were in their teens, but obviously not of the age to be legally drinking. We all did it. It is what it is. But I remember there was one night where everyone was playing beer pong, and they had a bunch of friends over in their garage area of their shore home. Beautiful home. That would end up being the first night that I got blackout drunk. I remember at the time my friend Colin, he was adamantly against drinking. If you had spoken to a 13-year-old Colin, he would have never touched it in his life. And as far as I know, to this day, never really got into it like that. He was a really good kid. But I remember that night, I was the polar opposite of Colin. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to do what I perceived the older, the cool kids to be doing. I learned how to play beer pong that night, and I was drinking the beers as I was losing. But what really did me in was the liquor. But I remember after a while of all of us drinking and the night dragging on, the lines between just how young I was compared to everybody else was kind of blurred. And again, I'm not blaming anybody for anything. I willingly wanted to get involved and have fun. But I remember there was this older girl, and she kept talking about how cute I was, yada yada, all this stuff. We were sharing drinks. We were taking shots together. She ended up giving me a kiss on the cheek. And after doing it again, I turned, and it became a full-on makeout sesh. I thought it was kind of cool. I took it as like a badge of honor as a kid, but growing older, I'm just like, dude, fucked up weird situation. Not cool on my part, not that cool on her part. But the simultaneous high and low point of the night came when I started getting the spins. Regardless of how many times I would encounter the spins after this, I will never forget the first time. It felt like I was in like a fun house, like a house of mirrors, but everything was tumbling over at the same time, like a cement churner, a cement truck, you know what I mean? I couldn't grab a hold of anything that was sturdy enough to keep me standing. And before I knew it, I was in the bathroom with Devin and Chris. I was trying to make myself throw up. Got to the point of dry heaving. After a good hour or so of just dry heaving and retching and puking my guts up, I started feeling like I was having fun again. And we started drinking more in the bathroom. I started freestyling drunk. Must have did it for about an hour and a half. Years down the line, when I'd be fortunate enough to actually pursue music as a career, rapping my ass off blackout drunk would end up being a regular occurrence. But I digress. I remember waking up the next day feeling like death itself. I had never experienced anything that serious before. I'd never been that sick as a child. But there was also a part of me that was immediately looking forward to doing it all again. I wanted to do it again. I remember being upset that they weren't having another party that night. I wouldn't end up drinking again until hanging out with some of my friends in Roxboro, where my brother and my mother and I were living at the time. So, for my freshman year of high school, I went to this school called FLC, Franklin Learning Center. In Franklin Learning Center, there was this kid. His nickname was Malo, and he sold weed. I had never really smoked weed before. I was like 14. And I remember buying two dimes off of him of what was called haze at the time. Like it was cool. But it wasn't no fucking special weed. Anyway, I copped like two dimes, brought them back to Roxboro to hang out with my boys. It was me, D-Rock, what up D-Rock, Adam, Matt, a couple other people. I remember where the drinking came in though, because not to say any names, but someone's older brother, we got them to run for us. They went, got us some beers. I don't know if we had 40s or if we had a case. I'm thinking we had a case. We didn't have 40s. We had a case. We had like a case or two, something like that. I remember we had a case. I had some weed. We rolled it up in some Phillies. At the time, that's what we were smoking. We didn't, none of us knew how to roll a Dutch. Backwoods weren't even that popping with people we knew. We rolled it up in Phillies. Nowadays, apparently they call it being cross-faded, but at the time, I just knew it as being fucked up. The initial connection that me and my boy D-Rock shared was skateboarding. Really, it was this girl named Gina that we both were seeing at the time, unbeknownst to each other. But once we got hip to the fact that she was kind of entertaining both of us, we somehow ended up meeting and just becoming cool off of mutual interests. I was into graffiti. He was really into graffiti. I was really into skateboarding. He was really into skateboarding. From there on, we started doing that shit together. We would trade music, put each other on to different stuff that we were listening to. And over the years, he became my first true best friend. The first person to actually do right by me as a friend, not only when I wasn't around, but while I was around. There was an innocence in our initial union, our initial bond. But it got to a point where I'm sure most friendships get to, where not only he and I, but all of our friends by association in our little crew or whatever, it got to a point where we stopped doing the shit that initially made us come together and be friends. And we started drinking. We started getting high. I talk about these first moments because now, being 956 days into my sobriety, I understand how it got to the point that it got to. But what at one point was something I did because I was curious became something that I did to have fun. And then what at one point I did to have fun became something I did to hide things, to mask the pain that I was feeling. It became something to numb me from the things I was unwilling to feel or afraid to face. Being that I didn't get into the high school of my choice freshman year, my only option was to try and get in there for sophomore year and ride that out till graduation. My boy D-Rock made it in first go, and while I was at FLC freshman year, he was at Kappa. Kappa is the Creative and Performing Arts High School of Philadelphia. My goal was to go there for theater. He went there for writing and eventually transferred to film. That whole year where I was at FLC and he was at Kappa, he was reporting back to his friends at school of all the shit that we would get into on the weekends. It was made apparent to me my first day at Kappa that I already had a reputation set for me when I walked in the door. And knowing what kind of person I just am naturally, I gotta not only meet that expectation, but I gotta top that shit. I gotta overdo it. I remember the first Kappa party like it was yesterday. It was at this girl Maya's house, and it was in West Philly. Me, D-Rock, and our boy Jazzy, what up Jazzy, we biked and took a bus there, I believe, but we ended up just completely biking the way back when it was all said and done. But while we were getting ready to go there, we knew we had a pregame. We each had a 40, we each had a Mad Dog, and we each had our own little personal stashes of weed. I remember being completely finished the bottle of Mad Dog that I had before I got in the house, and all I had left was the 40 to sip on. It was the dead of winter, and it was cold as shit. There was snow outside, but the roads were clear enough to where biking made sense. Again, we didn't have cars. We had bikes, and we used them. I'll spare you some of the details, because I'm sure I'll end up talking about them on another episode. But I went in that house with the mission to do shit that people would talk about and remember for years to come. Having graduated in 2013 and it now being 2021, I have not a single clue if anyone thinks about that day besides myself. More than likely, no one remembers and no one gives a fuck. Nonetheless, that whole week after that night, people were talking about what the fuck I got into, what I did with who, and then what I did with another who, and ultimately just how we were the life of the party. I had this idea about myself that I had to be some future rock star, some wild guy in training. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be seen as free, as reckless, as cool. Somewhere along the line in high school, about senior year, I started experiencing anxiety a lot more. Not only was I maturing physically, but my tastes were changing. And not really knowing how to handle it all, I started growing more secluded. I would isolate myself a lot more. It got to the point where I was no longer hanging out at the park after school, smoking with everybody, drinking with everybody, but I would go home and do that by myself, about 18, 19. I would still keep up appearances and go to any and every party I could with my boys and try to fulfill this reputation I had, or at least I told myself I had. But it got to the point where, now knowing what I know, I was really getting into the territory of self-medicating and trying to pacify myself. I remember there was this one week when I was 19, where I had blacked out on three separate occasions. I had blacked out on my way home or in the bar. And by some miracle, when I regained consciousness, there I was, smack in the middle of Trenton train station, my bike slung over my shoulder, or laying down on a bench with my bike in front of me. My stop was Tarsdale. I had the Tarsdale stop, which was a good 6 to 7 stops before Trenton. Trenton was the last stop. Never got robbed, was never assaulted. Completely normal, except for the vomit frozen on my shoes. The problem is that wouldn't end up being the end of my blacking out. Suffice it to say, blacking out and somehow making it home safely on my bike became a regular occurrence. It was something that, for lack of a better word, I took pride in. But especially working at the restaurant that I was working at, the culture was to make it through the shift and go spend all your fucking tips at the bar down the street, which was called Kite and Key. 22 is when I started going by myself, even when the crew didn't feel like going. A lot of people talk about 21 being the age where everyone goes wild, but the year where it all came crashing down for me was 22. When I hit 22, I had decided that I was no longer going to be reserved anymore. I wasn't going to be particular with not only where I went, but who I chose to share myself with. I pretty much decided to just become for any and everybody. I was taking on various partners, and I wasn't doing it in a smart way, safe to say. But luckily, you know, made it through with a clean record in both ways. But it started getting to the point where I would wake up an hour or two late for work, still drunk, have to go in the walk of shame, and continue on if they let me. Most of the time, they did. You know that your drinking is a problem when the people that you consider to be worse drinkers than you start talking about it. And that's what was going on. I had coworkers kind of stage mini interventions with me. I had coworkers stop talking to me and fucking with me completely. And I took offense to it because I'm like, what the we get fucked up together. Like, what's the problem? I wasn't aware of just how out of hand it had gotten. I wasn't aware of how much harder I was going than everyone else was. I thought that's what we were all doing. But the one night I remember more than anything was getting drunk after my shift at the Kite and Key, getting in the car to go home, and somewhere along my 15 to 20 minute drive to South Philly, I had blacked out. I had lost consciousness. Mind you, I either had to take 76 or Broad Street, which means either way I'm navigating through a bunch of other vehicles. But with the Broad Street route, there's traffic lights at every intersection. Either one I took, somehow I made it back to South Philly. The problem with South Philly is that it's hard as hell to find a parking spot late at night. Every spot's usually claimed, and people are fast asleep in their beds, so they can wake up and go to work like I had to the next morning. When I woke up, in the vehicle, still running, 6 a.m, I realized that apparently I wasn't able to find a spot. I realized this because I was parked in front of some public school about 11 blocks from my house. I was parked in front of the gate to the schoolyard because it was the only opening that could fit a car. My windows were rolled down, key still in the ignition, car still running, and there was a water bottle in the passenger seat. Now, I couldn't remember shit, but I definitely remembered that I didn't have a water bottle in that car. And I definitely didn't grab one before I'd started the drive home. Which means someone either put it there when they walked by and noticed me in the car, blacked out, slumped over, or my memory shit. I just remember feeling really embarrassed. I remember feeling like a piece of shit. I'm pretty sure I was only in double digits in my checking account. I had not a dollar in my savings. All I had on me was cash around those days. And I checked myself, checked my possessions. Nothing was stolen from me. I had everything on me still. Again, I was spared. I've made it home at least 50 times while completely blackout drunk behind the wheel. Not a scratch on me, not a scratch on another vehicle. I got away with it in my Mazda pickup. I got away with it in my Hyundai Accent, I got away with it in my father's Durango. Fast forward to around December of 2018. If I wasn't at my boy Ruffin's house working on some music, on any given day, all that I was doing was getting as high as I possibly could to just sedate myself and lay in bed, watch porn and masturbate, and then get as fucked up as I could drinking tequila until I would pass out. What I realize now is I started experiencing psychosis in a serious way. I was paranoid more than I had ever been before. It was almost as if I wasn't sleeping, I was in a constant state of feeling like at any moment I had to be prepared to defend my life. And the only thing that would cure that was pacifying myself, sedating myself. It was just a constant cycle of getting high, jacking off to porn, and getting as drunk as I possibly could. But there was something that clicked in my mind. I started thinking about all the things that got me to the point that I was at. And one of the situations that stood out the most is one of those two things that I talked about doing at a very early age at the beginning of this episode. Mind you, I was experiencing psychosis. I was having a mental breakdown. It's something that I still struggle with to this day in regards to my sexuality. Not in terms of who I'm into or what I'm into, but how I'm into it. And because of that, I had decided in December of 2018 that I was going to exact revenge on this person. I decided that it was in my best interest, coming from a place of pain, and whatever happens after that, I didn't give a fuck. Whether that meant going to prison or taking my own life. But around that time, I was still communicating with people to an extent. Two of them being my brother, Alex, and my uncle Joe. I consider myself someone that's always been good at sweeping things under the rug and appearing to be fine, even in the midst of a complete shitstorm. But around that time, unbeknownst to me, it was clear as day that something was terribly fucking wrong with me. My brother ended up making the call to my uncle saying, "Hey, we need to get Kane some help." I'm pretty sure at one point I had mentioned to my brother what I was planning on doing. My uncle, having been exposed to this type of behavior before from my father, decided it was in not only my but our best interest for me to go seek professional psychiatric help, which led to me being admitted to Horsham Clinic, which is a psychiatric facility, a mental hospital, a loony bin, you know. At first, when I was being admitted, you know, having to strip down, have them search me to make sure I'm not harboring any weapons, I felt like a bad dog. Like, I felt like I had fucked up. And that this was the turning point in my life in the wrong direction. There were so many times that first day, and I remember writing it all in my journal. I could have sworn this was the beginning of a future filled with prison stints, with violence, with crime, with struggle, with hopelessness. But looking back now, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I remember when I hit my first week in Horsham Clinic, realizing that this had been the first 7-day stretch of complete sobriety since I was, 14? And I remember talking with one of the doctors there about how, in order to live a seemingly normal life with bipolar 1 disorder, it would be in my best interest to abstain from drugs and alcohol, to go completely sober, clean and sober. And I was ready to do it. It made a lot of sense. But of course, that night that I got discharged from the hospital, I had picked my car up at my Uncle Joe's, and I immediately went to go buy a fuckload of weed and get myself a bottle of Espolón tequila so I could go back to my room, watch all the porn that I could fucking watch, and get fucked up. on the way there, I had this girl calling me, freaking the fuck out, talking about how she hasn't been able to get through to me in weeks. I didn't have her on my call list at the hospital for a reason, but nonetheless, this person didn't believe that I had actually been in a psych ward the whole time, that she hadn't heard from me, especially because at that point, I had based so much of our relationship, if you want to call it that, off of lies to keep up with other lies that I was telling other girls, and yada, yada, yada. It continues. So the first night I get out the hospital, it's my, you know, I got a little streak of sobriety in me. I go get high as fuck, drunk as fuck, watching all this fucking porn and shit. And I got this girl calling me, freaking the fuck out, threatening me, talking about how she's missed her period, might be pregnant, all this crazy shit. I had a fucking panic attack. It was like one of the first real fucking panic attacks I had ever had in my life. And I was really high and really drunk. And I had like, it was a whole mixture of crazy shit. And I just remember the phrase, be careful what you wish for, playing over and over and over and over in my head. So I drank some more, blacked out, woke up the next day feeling all right. Fast forward to Valentine's Day, 2019. The moment that kickstarted the rest of my life took place on Valentine's Day, 2019. I was with my boy Ruffin, his girlfriend Annie, and her cousins Dolly and Vicky. And we were in Dolly's apartment in South Philly, doing what we normally do, hanging out, eating good food, and drinking wine and tequila, my two alcohols of choice. I remember that night, even with everyone around each other, feeling like I wasn't really drinking with them. I was drinking by myself with them. Like, I was drinking by myself near them. You might not get it, but those that have experienced this will. And I remember as the night was winding down, I was anticipating what was soon to come, which is that long drive home. My drive home had grown longer because my old roommate Jason broke the lease on the apartment we had while I was in the mental hospital, so at that time, I was living at my Aunt Kim's house up in Bensalem, which if you know Philly, Bensalem is far the fuck away from South Philly. Anyway, I was dreading the drive home because that's when the sadness kicks in. That's when the depression and the loneliness kicks in. I was good and drunk, but I had it on good authority to know I wasn't gonna black out on the ride home. But I remember after saying goodbye to everybody and going down and getting in my car, I remember sitting there and just letting it wash over me for a bit before I started the car. Clear as day, there was a dialogue going on in my head. I was on a bunch of anti-psych meds. I was on prescription sleep aids. A bunch of shit. We'll get into that on another episode. I'll never forget it. It was clear as day. There was a voice in my head saying, you're good tonight. You're fucked up, but you're good. You're gonna make it home. Tomorrow, you may not be so lucky. And I remember just really considering it and thinking about it. I'm like, yo, like, can I do this shit? Will I still be interesting? Will I still be cool? Will I still have things to talk about and sing about and rap about? Will people want to spend time with me anymore? All my friends get fucked up and drink. If I don't do it anymore, am I going to have friends anymore? And I didn't quite know the answer to that, but I knew that if I were to die driving home drunk one night, the answer to all of those questions would be no anyway. So I said, fuck it. And I started the car and I drove the fuck home. And as I said before, at the time I'm recording this episode, I'm 956 days clean and sober. I don't smoke weed. I don't drink. And in all honesty, I don't take my medication neither. We'll talk about that on another episode. What has helped me gain some control over not only my mental health, but my life in general, has been my decision to go completely sober. Because in choosing to go completely sober, I was choosing to leave my old role behind. I was choosing to no longer play the character I was accustomed to playing, and I was choosing to begin playing a new one. And with this new character I'm playing, the story's so much better. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. What's poppin'? This is the Kane Show.